To have David Eisenblatt visiting us. As you know, he's director of MSRI and a good friend of Kim's, and he's here really on a speaking visit, but also doing a bit of business while he's here on our joint ventures. David was a student of,
I have a copy of this.
Saunders McLean, as was John McDonald. And joined the faculty at Brandeis, I think, in 1970, he told me. Mm-hmm. And was there until quite recently when he moved to UC Berkeley as part of his big career change coming to MSRI.
Moving question.
And we're happy to have you in the West, especially to visit. David, you may know some of his books, which are very popular on algebraic geometry and commutative algebra with a view toward algebraic
right.
geometry.
Yes.
And another book, Joe Harris, on
schemes.
Schemes.
Yeah. Geometry of schemes.
Geometry of schemes. I had it written down. So let's welcome David.
Speaking of books, I learned knot theory from Dale's book years ago, and it was an inspiration of exposition and nice things, so I've always admired that. I'd like to tell you about some work that I've done in recent time with Soren Popescu and others. The particular things I'll talk about today will be mostly from joint work actually with Frank Schreier, but Soren Popescu and Sergei Yuzvinsky and Jerzy Wayman have all been part of a series of projects centered around the use of the exterior algebra. This is going to have to wait. Go away. Centered around the use of the exterior algebra in studying algebraic geometry and studying cohomology of hyperplane complements, things like that. The idea is to take seriously the fact that cohomology groups or, different kinds of cohomology groups in different settings naturally come in a structure which has to do with the exterior algebra, something which has not been much exploited, though it's been known for a long time, and to use the module structure and the free resolution structure over the exterior algebra. Now, I don't want to start with that. I want to start instead with resultants and Chow forms, which are one of the applications, as I say, in work with Schreier. But if I go very fast, I might get back to the exterior algebra before the end of the hour. So let me start at the beginning of the story. The beginning is really, I think, with Leibniz in 1692. At least I haven't found anything older than that. And the observation that although it's really quite hard to solve a polynomial equation, it's much easier to solve two equations in the sense that you can check whether two polynomials in one variable have a common root much more easily than you can find the roots of one. Now, these days, I think most of you would say, well, how do you do that? Let's see. You take use the Euclidean algorithm to divide one by the other, and you get a remainder, and then you divide it again, and so on. But you can do those things all at once, and this is sort of Leibniz's observation. You can linearize the problem in a certain sense. And one way to state it is this. If you have f of x and g of x, or let's call it, I guess I better say g of x, polynomials in one variable have a common root, which you can find various ways, if and only if a certain linear system of equations, homogeneous linear system of equations, has a solution, a non-trivial solution. Well, this is true, as I've written it, only if you include solutions of these things at infinity, but I won't worry about that refinement for the moment. This is very easy from our point of view. Of course, these two have a common root, if and only if their least common multiple has degree less than the sum of the degrees. Let's say they have degrees D and E. Then, if you want to find what the linear equations are, you can write something like H of X, F of X, equals K of X, G of X. And for them to have a common root means that this equation is solvable for polynomials H and K of degrees, let's say, E minus 1 and D minus 1. So the total degree is less than the sum of the 2 degrees. Right? Now, if you think about that, if you just write out this formula brutally, then this becomes a system of linear equations for the coefficients of H and K. If you think how many equations there are and how many unknowns, well, the total degree of this, let's see, this was of degree D, so the total degree of this is D plus E minus 1. A polynomial of degree D plus E minus 1 has D plus E coefficients. So this is D plus E equations. On the other hand, H has E coefficients and K has D coefficients, so I have D plus E unknowns. So this is a nice square system of linear equations, the kind we love best. And it's obvious from this formulation that these two have a common root if and only if the system of linear equations that's sort of implicitly written down over there is solvable. And of course, I've secretly used the fact that F really had degree D and not something less than degree D. So in some sense, as I've written it, it's only true if the leading coefficients are non-zero, but this is a minor problem that you can refine away if you think about it right. Yeah, so we could write these equations down explicitly. Let me not do it in general, though you probably have seen them before, but do it for the special case where D and E are both 2. And then, so F and G have some coefficients, 3 coefficients apiece, right? It's AX squared plus BX plus C. And the way that we've learned to do this comes down to us from Sylvester, actually. So this is kind of Sylvester's reformulation of Leibniz's argument. And what you're supposed to do in this case is to write down the coefficients of F twice, with a little shift this way. And then you're supposed to write down the coefficients of G twice, too. Let's call them A prime, B prime, C prime. So F is AX squared plus BX plus C. And G is A prime, X squared plus, and so on. So I'd write A prime, B prime, C prime. And 0, A prime, B prime, C prime. And then the equations represented by that matrix are the system of equations you get. It's trivial to check. And so the determinant of this matrix tells you whether or not you can solve the equations. If the determinant is 0, you can solve them. If it's not 0, you can't solve them. And this determinant is called the resultant of the 2 equations. So this is the most classical piece of algebra that most people ever learn, probably. Very basic observation, and an important one. It's important today from a point of view which is a little bit different than the original point of view. We think of this as the beginning of elimination theory, usually. And elimination theory is about taking the projection of a set. If you have a set in 3-space or an n-space defined by some algebraic equations, and you want to project it to a smaller dimensional space, then it's not even obvious that the image is defined by algebraic equations, but it is. And the business of how you find them, eliminating the variables in the direction you're projecting along, is the business of elimination theory. It's now often done by Gröbner bases, but in fact, in many cases, these resultants are much more efficient, and the computer scientists, unlike the mathematicians, like resultants better than Gröbner bases for that reason. So you can sort of pre-compute a formula for the resultant, maybe, and then apply it in the special cases. This is a good strategy. This appears in a different way, too, a generalization of this, which is extremely important for geometry, and is close to the things I want to describe in the what's now called usually the Chao form. It might as well be called the Keli form. It is often called the Keli form after work of Keli's in the middle of the last century. And it comes from the following idea. If you look at algebraic varieties, typically if you write down some properties of an algebraic variety and then look at all the varieties with that property, they form a family, or maybe a finite union of families, or an infinite union. But the families are themselves algebraic varieties. This is a basic feature of the landscape in algebraic geometry, which is makes it unique in some way. I mean, you don't think of the family of all manifolds of a certain kind as being a manifold, but that's the way life is in algebraic geometry. This comes from the case of plane curves first. So if you look at plane curves of degree D, let's say curves in the projective plane, so that's homogeneous forms and three variables of degree D, that's just a vector space. And two forms give the same curve if and only if they differ by a scalar, so it's really a projective space itself. So you, in the earliest days, people studied that projective space of curves a lot. And then when they came to study curves in three space, of course they wanted to do the same thing. It's not so obvious, though, how to do that. If you think about it, you could get a curve in three space by taking the intersection of two surfaces, and then you could write down the coefficients of those two polynomials. A surface in three space is given by one polynomial again. So you write down the coefficients, and so you get two sets of coefficients. That's not so bad. Unfortunately, lots of curves are not well described by pairs of surfaces. In fact, it's not known whether all smooth curves can be given that way in three space, and certainly not true for the analogous cases in higher dimensions, so, or for singular curves in three space. So one needed a different idea, and Cayley met this problem head on and solved it actually in a very brilliant way. So let me describe to you Cayley's solution. It's the following. So the idea is to describe the family of space curves. So everything is algebraic in this talk, and if you push me, I'll admit that it's projective space that I'm talking about. Maybe we're over the complex numbers, though that doesn't matter so much. But describe the family of space curves. Well, of given degree, that's what we did for the plane. Plane curves of a given degree are that projective space. Why shouldn't we do it here? Of given degree as an algebraic variety. Now, first of all, what's the degree of a space curve? Well, if you take a space curve and cut it with a hyperplane, a plane in space, in general you get finitely many points. And if you wiggle the plane around to make sure that you didn't have any funny tangencies or things, then the number of points is the degree of the curve, and that's the nicest invariant. It's also the only topological invariant. It tells you the homology class of the curve as a subset of the space. So that's a very reasonable object, the degree. Now, how can you do this? Well, let's think about this curve. Here's a typical space curve. And how are we going to define it? It's defined by 1,000 equations and four variables. There's no way of... And if you just vary the coefficients, you're out of luck, because you move them a little bit and it turns out they define the empty set after that. So that's not a way of defining all curves of that degree. However, Cayley, I don't know how he had this idea, but it's certainly a brilliant one. He noticed that if you think of a line, if you think of a one-parameter family of lines making up a plane, so I just think of passing a line through this, then the lines in this family will meet the curve finitely many times in a one-parameter family. So another way of saying that, which would appeal to Cayley or anybody doing algebraic geometry, is that in the family of all lines in three space, the lines that meet this curve should be codimension 1. Now, codimension 1 things, like plane curves, tend to be given by one equation. So you could take the equation of that set of lines, if you could figure out what that meant, as the sort of point that defines this space curve. That's what Cayley did. That works. It's sort of amazing that works even after you describe it. But it does. So there are a lot of things to be said. So we associate to this the set of lines meeting. So this is the curve x, let's say, the set of lines meeting. X, let's call it d sub x. Now, first of all, where is d sub x? There are two different places you might seek to locate this object. You might think, well, a line is given by two planes. So let's take the coefficients of the linear forms that define those two planes. That's four coefficients for each linear form. That's two three-dimensional projective spaces, really. P3 cross P3. Plane cross plane. Plane comma plane. So you might think of it in P3 cross P3. Or, somewhat more intrinsically and more naturally, you might say, no, I don't really want to distinguish one of those planes from the other because I could take the same line as the intersection in a different way. Let's think of the line just as a line. Surely lines make up some nice variety. After all, here we're supposed to be doing it for curves of degree D. We better do it first for curves of degree 1, that is to say lines. And indeed, the lines make up the Grassmannian, right? Everybody knows about the Grassmannian. So why not take dx there? So you could alternately take dx contained in the Grassmannian of lines in P3. This is G2-4 in many people's notation. I don't know how you like to think of it. All right, so that's a good idea. Now, does that set of lines really determine the curve? That's an important question here. Well, if you think about the lines through one point of the curve, they form a two-plane of lines, because I could take a two-plane out here, and then that line is determined by where it meets the two-plane. So that's a genuine two-plane sitting inside the Grassmannian, and those are kind of distinguished objects in the Grassmannian. And this curve, you can see easily enough that there's no point off the curve such that all the lines through that point meet the curve. Right? So the curve is defined, can be redefined as the set of points such that all the lines going through that point lie in dx. So indeed we can get back to the curve. That's easy. That's good. Now let's see. I convinced you maybe that dx is codimension 1 in here or in here. It doesn't really matter. This thing maps to this, and so this dx is just the pre-image of this one. Dx is codimension 1. It's pretty clear in here that something of codimension 1 is given by one equation, though it takes a moment's thought. Here it's a little less clear, but it's still true. It's true in any Grassmannian that any codimension 1 subvariety is given by one equation in, for instance, the Plücker coordinates. So this is naturally embedded in this particular case, P5, as a four-dimensional hyperquadric. If you think about it, if you write down, so how is a line given? Two linear forms. Well, that's a matrix, A0, A1, A2, A3. Those are the coefficients of the first linear form. B0 up to B3, the coefficients of the second. And then the Plücker coordinates of this set are the 2x2 minors. So there are 6 2x2 minors, choice of 2 things out of 4, and that means we're in P5. But the Plücker coordinates satisfy one relation, namely, if you think of the minors as delta ij, then delta, 0, 1 times delta 2, 3 minus delta 0, 2, sorry, 2, 3, delta 1, 3 plus delta 0, 3, delta 1, 2 is 0. So they satisfy this quadratic relation. This is all an example. Everything here generalizes to codimension K planes in an N space, and you have Plücker relations, which are quadratic relations like this. Anyway, in this case, it's quite simple to describe. And sure enough, any codimension 1 subvariety modulo this equation is defined by a single equation. So we get a polynomial in either of these two ways associated to our curve. Now, there's one more step to this argument before you can declare victory. You have to say that the set of polynomials that actually come from curves is an algebraic subvariety. It has to be an algebraic condition to come from a curve. And it is. That was Chow's thesis. And that's the reason why I think of this as Chow forms. This is a famous paper of Chow and van der Waarden. Van der Waarden was Chow's advisor. It's become less fashionable to publish your student's thesis with your student, but at the time it apparently was acceptable. So this is the Chow form, and leads to the notion of the Chow variety. That's the first idea of what a moduli space can be. As I say, it comes back to Cayley, but was developed by Chow very much subsequently. The Chow variety is then the set of all these dx's that you get, which come from curves. People still don't understand how to write down the equations of the Chow variety very well, but you can prove they exist, and that's where we are. Chow varieties and such things have become very important in recent time. There's cohomology theories based on looking at Chow varieties. The Chow variety plays a major role in the construction of the moduli space of curves, as we now use it, and as all the physicists use it. This is a very central object in modern algebraic geometry, although its properties are still not very well known.
When was his work?
Chow? 1937 is that paper. Yeah. Right. Tough times in Germany then. All right. So, well, let's see. That's sort of nice, but what is... So, could you please give me an example of the Chow variety? That's sort of the natural next question. Or at least of a Chow form, right? I'll give you the curve, now you tell me the Chow form. That's pretty hard computationally. In fact, it's already hard in this simple case. So, resultants are really a special case of Chow forms. I guess I didn't explain why that's true. But let me do that now. Let's take the simplest curve in P3, which is not contained in a hyperplane, the so-called twisted cubic. Everybody should... How many people here know what the twisted cubic is already? How many algebraic geometers, in other words, do I have in my audience? A fair number. So here's what the twisted cubic is. It's a way of embedding the projective line into projective three space. And the idea is this. You take coordinates on the projective line, which are, you know, two numbers up to common scalar multiple, and, oops, you map it. Map that point to the point with coordinates s cubed, s squared t, s t squared, and t cubed. Obviously, you could do this with any number of variables and any degree you like, and you have what are called the Veronese embeddings of projective spaces. So, there's an example. Now, if I think about it this way, then a linear form... So, I now want to... I want to ask, what is the Chow hypersurface associated to this curve? What's its meaning? Well, first of all, what are we supposed to do? We have to go back and remember. We got to take a line, and the primitive way of thinking of a line is as the intersection of two hyperplanes. So what's a plane here? Well, a plane is given by the vanishing of one linear form, four coefficients, as I said. But a linear form here is the same as a cubic form in two variables, right? So a plane here is really, when I restrict to P1, is a cubic. A second plane is a second cubic. They meet in a line, of course, and that line meets the curve if and only if the two equations thought of back here have a common zero. Right? So the Chow form of this is the resultant of two cubics, two binary cubics. And in general, resultants are Chow forms. You have to generalize the notion of Chow form a little in a different direction in order to make that statement absolutely true. But what is primitively true is that the resultant of R plus 1 polynomials and R plus 1 variables of degree D, all of degree D, is on the nose a Chow form of the Veronese. You get all sorts of other interesting resultants this way. For instance, suppose you want to look at three curves in the plane. So the resultant, the question of whether three curves in a plane meet in a point is the answered by the resultant of three polynomials in three variables, right? But suppose you want a different question. Suppose you want to answer the question. Suppose the curve's already passed through a point that you know, or maybe 17 points that you know, and you want to know if there's another point. What's the condition on the coefficients that they pass through an 18th point? Well, that's the Chow form of not the Veronese embedding of the plane, but an embedding of the plane blown up, those first 17 points. So lots of algebraic geometry can be transformed into statements about resultants of funny kinds, things like that, if you want to do that, by this notion of Chow form, this method. Why didn't I do the Chow form in this case? Why did I take cubics? Well, I will now do it in this case for you, but you have to understand that we're doing something strange. This corresponded to two conics in the plane. Two conics in the plane. So I'm supposed to look at the embedding, two quadratic polynomials in two variables, right? Here. These are binary forms. I did it in one variable, but I could homogenize and think of it as forms in two variables. So I'm supposed to do this, but with quadratic forms here instead of cubic forms. Now there are three quadratic forms, and the image of this map is the conic in the plane. Now what am I looking at when I look at the Chow form of a conic? I haven't explained the general formulation, but the idea is to look at linear spaces whose codimension is one more than the dimension of the variety you're looking at. Here we took a variety of dimension 1 and we looked at linear spaces of codimension 2. In the plane, I take a curve of dimension 1. I look at linear spaces of codimension 2 again. Those are points in the plane. So the Chow form is supposed to be the set of all points that lie on the curve. Hey, that's easy. That's the equation of the curve. Except I got a quartic equation instead of a quadratic equation. Now, how did that happen? Well, the answer is that I looked in the wrong place. I looked in this space, and what that really is a bi-homogeneous equation of degree 2-2. But wouldn't it be better just to see the quadratic equation? Well, the quadratic equation is what you get here in the Grassmannian. So let me rewrite this Sylvester formula for you so you can see that. If I rewrite Sylvester, remember the curve we're looking at is S squared ST T squared, the set of all such points in the plane. And you can easily see what the equation is. It's the first thing times the last thing minus the middle thing squared. So it's x naught x2 minus x1 squared. So this is the equation we would like to see as the Chow form. What if we look in the Grassmannian? Now, as I said, the Grassmannian has coordinates which are the 2x2 minors of something or other. It's the 2x2 minors of A, B, C, A prime, B prime, C prime. So let's rewrite this matrix so that those things appear together. We have A, B, C, A prime, B prime, C prime, and there's some zeros, and then 0, 0, A, B, C, A prime, B prime, C prime. We're supposed to take the determinant of that. And now let's do it in terms of the Plicker coordinates, which are, as I say, the 2x2 minors of this 2x3 matrix. So that, what is that? Well, I expand the determinant along the first two rows and the last two rows. So I have to multiply this minor by this minor, first of all. And that's delta 0, 1 times delta 1, 2. And then there are some other minors, too. Well, here's one. I have to multiply this minor by this minor. And they're the same. That's convenient. So I get minus delta 0, 2 squared. It looks pretty good. And now there are a lot of other terms, right? There are six terms in this expression, but they're all zero, the other ones, because they involve this column or this column. So this is the sort of the right way of looking at the curve. And in general, the expression here is much more compact and much nicer. This is called the Bézout expression of the resultant. And for the resultant of two forms in two variables, of two forms of degree D in two variables. There is a famous formula, due to Bezu, which gives this as a determinant, just as here. Now, here's the dirty secret about resultants and Chow forms. We can't compute them. It's extremely hard in general, and has been a matter of deepest art, to go from, developed over a whole century of work, to go from either just the case of, you know, degree D and R plus 1 forms and R plus 1 variables to a polynomial expression, or more generally to go from the expression of an algebraic variety to a polynomial expression for the Chow form. So for instance, if you look at the problem of computing the resultant of R plus 1 forms, R plus 1 variables, and degree D. Well, for R equals 2, there's no problem. And you can get a Bezu formula or the other kind of formula. I didn't say what that's called, but it's often called the Stiefel formula, the formula that corresponds to the embedding in P3 cross P3. So here we have both Bezu and the easier Stiefel formula, so it's enough to say Bezu there. For R equals 3, there were Stiefel formulas known, but even for quadrics, for forms of degree 2, there were no Bezu forms known. Well, the sheet that I handed out is a Bezu form for that case. I have to interpret this for you. The Plicker coordinates are given by triples of numbers in this setting. We're looking here at the embedding of P2 into P5 by all quadratic polynomials, all quadratic monomials, with Veronese embedding, P5. And we're looking at its Chow form. So we have to take planes whose codimension is one more than the dimension of the variety. Planes of codimension 3, that's two planes in P5. The general two-plane in P5 will miss the P2, but there'll be a codimension 1 subset which meets the P2, and the equation of that codimension 1 subset is the Chow form. So planes of codimension 2 have three equations, and therefore given by in Plicker coordinates by the 3x3 minors of something. 3x3 minor is distinguished by three columns of a 3x6 matrix. So these numbers, 2, 4, 5, 3, 4, 5, are the column numbers. I haven't written the deltas. This matrix is supposed to be skew symmetric. There are zeros down the diagonal, and there are the stuff under the diagonal is just the negative of the stuff above. Skew symmetric matrices, determinants have natural square roots called the Pfaffian. There's a polynomial formula in the entries, just like the determinant formula, which gives the square root of the determinant. And the assertion here is that the Pfaffian of that particular matrix is the resultant of three quadratic forms and three variables. There is no determinantal formula known in this case. Now, if you look at the history of this kind of question, so there are now Bezu formulas known for any degree D, and maybe I should continue this list. For R equals 4, there were Stiefel coordinate forms, and now there are Bezu forms as well, from the work of all this is new stuff is from Schreier and my work. For R equals 5, as the highest state of the art, the furthest anybody has gotten, was to write down a formula, polynomial formula, and I'll explain this caveat in a moment, for the case of degree 3 up to now. Degree less than or equal to 3, we had Stiefel formulas. Now, with this new work, we can do it also for degrees 4, 6, and 8. And that's the new state of the art. I can't go any further than that. But in general, it's very hard to write down polynomial formulas for these things. And has been for a long time. This 4, 6, and 8 comes from a careful exploitation of the Horrocks-Mumford bundle, in fact. Kind of unique object on P that lives on P4 and has many amazing properties, one of which is to give these formulas. Now, how does this all come about? What is the real meaning of this? Well, first of all, people wanted determinantal formulas. This was so nice. Why can't we just write down some big determinant? If you look at the polynomials that you get, they're very complicated polynomials with thousands of terms, but still, a determinant is like that too. Why shouldn't they be determinants? And these cases that I've written down, the old cases, all are determinantal formulas, whereas the new cases, where we can go beyond what was known before, are all Pfaffian formulas like that. I'll say why that Pfaffian comes about. But in general, people were looking for some sort of compact way of representing this very complicated polynomial. And in some sense, the problem was solved completely by Cayley. So I should explain what Cayley did. Cayley had an amazing idea for doing this, even though he couldn't write down a determinantal formula. So Cayley's idea, this is about 1850, and it has been generalized very strongly since by Grothendieck and others. And somehow it's Grothendieck's understanding that I'm going to explain to you. This is about 1970. When is this? I guess it's in the late 60s. Cayley said that you have to generalize determinant a little bit, right? We generalize the resultant, let's generalize the determinant too. He's only interested in elimination theory and resultants. It's Grothendieck who realized this was good for Chow forms in general. And so Cayley said, what we really need is not the determinant but the of a matrix, but the determinant of a complex. So this is a rather natural idea. And if I leave you with any new idea, maybe it will be this one. How many people here know what the determinant of a complex is already? Anybody? Ah, I have something to give you, a present to give you. Okay, so I need some little bit of technical ideas. First of all, the complexes that I'm going to work with are going to be finite, free, and generically exact. And if you're an algebraic geometer, you can put the word locally in here without any suffering. But if you're not, then you might want to think about the simple case. So what does this mean? In the most primitive case, and this is something that works very much more generally than what I'm going to say, you think that you have a bunch of matrices, not just one, written in order. And finally, it's a finite sequence of matrices like this. And each matrix has entries which are polynomial functions. For most values of the variables, this is an exact sequence in the sense that the image of each matrix is the kernel of the one that comes next. That's what generically exact means. And for all values of the variables, well, it would follow from that, the composition of any two matrices, the product of any two matrices next to each other is zero. That's what it means to be a complex. Oops, complex. Okay, so that's what we've got. Now, of course, we don't anymore think of it as a bunch of matrices that vary. We think of it as maps of free modules. Let's call this S to the N0. S is the polynomial ring here. Could be over the complex numbers or any place you like in a bunch of variables. S to the N0 up to S to the NK, let's say. And I'm going to put zeros at the ends to emphasize that this thing comes to an end. And here's S to the N1, S to the N2, and so on. So I have a bunch of free modules. That's why it's a free complex. Maps between them. That's what it means to be a complex. The composition of pairs is zero. And generically, meaning for almost every value that the points x0 up to xn takes, this is exact. That's the setting in which I want to define a determinant. Now, of course, we better look back and see what we did for a single matrix to know what to do. Was there a question? Yeah. Please.
Sorry, these are modules over what, the polynomial ring?
In this case, I'm going to take S to be the polynomial ring. It doesn't really matter. I could do this over an arbitrary scheme. This is a very general construction, just as determinants are, right? A determinant of a map of vector bundles is what I'm generalizing. Generically isomorphism of vector bundles, right? So anyway, what's the case of one matrix? So I have a matrix and the entries are Pij of x naught up to xn, something like that. So the complex looks like 0 goes to s to the n1, goes to s to the n naught, goes to 0. And now, for this to be generically exact, that means the kernel of this matrix has to be 0 for almost all values of the pi of x. So, in particular, n1 has to be less than or equal to n0. On the other hand, the co-kernel has to be 0 for almost all values, so n0 has to be less than or equal to n1, so they have to be equal. It's a square matrix. Haha. So I can actually take the determinant, and to say that it's generically exact, exactly means that the determinant is non-zero. Let's call this matrix A. Det A non-zero. This is the situation that is generalized over here. And then, well, guess what? The determinant of the complex is defined to be det A. Right? Equals determinant of the complex. All right, so that was neither very hard nor very interesting. The first case of interest is the next one, where you have two terms. And from that case, you can sort of guess all the rest of the cases. So the next case is going to look like this. Let me do it in general then. Maybe I'll do an example. So here's s to the n1, s to the n2. And here we have a and b. Now, first of all, what about n0, n1, n2? How many of them are free variables? Again, generic exactness means, first of all, that n2, but this is almost always a monomorphism, so n2 is less than or equal to n1, but its image is almost always the kernel of A. Of course, the kernel of A has generically dimension n1 minus n0, if this is generically onto, which it's supposed to be. So, in fact, n1 has to be n0 plus n2. That's a consequence of generic exactness. And the rest of generic exactness is that the rank of A is n0, the rank of B is n1, and of course we have this a complex, that means that AB is 0. Okay, so that's the conditions up here, and what it means are the hypothesis in this whole construction. Now, what can we do with this project, right? It looks vaguely as if there's a square matrix to be made out of this somehow, but how do you do it? So, let's think of A as a wide but not very tall matrix. So this is n0, and here's n1, which is n0 plus n2 columns, whereas B is a tall but not very wide matrix, right? The number of columns is n2, the number of rows is m0 plus n2. Well, I want a determinant. I'll just take a determinant. Let's be bold about this. There's a determinant. Let's call it a prime. How about calling that the determinant of the complex? That seems hopelessly naive, right? And it is hopelessly naive. It doesn't reflect the rest of the complex very well. Can I get B into the act somehow? Well, if you think about it, if I've distinguished the first n0 columns, that is the first n0 basis vectors n1, then what I've really got is I can make out of that the projection from s to the n1 to s to the n1 minus n0. The rest of the basis vectors, and that's n2. So there's a corresponding to A prime, there's a sort of complementary square matrix of size n2. This is of size n1. Here's a complementary square matrix of size n2 sitting inside B. Call it B prime. And then let's call this complex F or something like that. And then I define the determinant of F to be the determinant of A prime divided by the determinant of B prime. This is Cayley. This is due to Cayley. Now, there should be an outcry from the audience, of course. What happened if you took a different A prime? And there are other possible invariances that you could ask for, too. Now, it turns out that you get the same answer if you take a different A prime. That's what happens. So, if you don't believe that, let's do an example. Simplest non-trivial example. So, A is going to be 1 by 2 matrix. And B is correspondingly going to be a 2 by 1 matrix. Let's take this to be, for instance, not to make life too complicated, x1, x2. Okay? And B to be, well, it has to compose with this to 0. What maps will compose to 0 with it? Well, if I multiply P times x1 and have it be equal to Q times x2, then by unique factorization, P has to be x2 times something, P prime, and so on. So let's see if I can write that down. So here I have x2 times something, let's call it F. And here I have minus x1 times the same F. That's the only kind of matrix which will compose to 0 with this. All right? So now I choose the first block here and the last block here, and I get x1 divided by x1f, which is 1 over f. And you can see that it's the same answer if I do the same here with the last block divided by the first block. I get x2f. There's a little sign problem, of course. Well, you have, just as with all determinants, there are signs that come from permutations. These blocks actually come with signs that tell you how the columns were chosen from among all the columns. So to get this right, you have to put in the sign. Let me just say plus or minus. I don't care much about the plus or minus for the following reason. Even in the case of a single matrix, the determinant is not really well defined. It's only well defined up to changes of basis, and they're not trivial. They mean multiplication by a unit. So this whole thing is really only defined up to a unit, but that's enough to make a divisor out of it. Remember, two polynomials which differ by a unit define the same algebraic variety in projective space. So these things are well-defined divisors and not so well-defined rational functions. Right. So now, Cayley's observation was that you could cook up a particular complex. I think I'd better hurry a little bit now in this last bit. I didn't tell you about three matrices. Can you do the three matrix case for yourselves? I just drew a picture. So the first one will be long and short. The second one is sort of squarish. The third one is tall and narrow. You take a block from the first. This block corresponds to somehow the first columns. You throw them away. And you take a block from the second set of columns. This block corresponds, by complementation again, to the right. So I'm now going to throw away this middle. And I take this plus this. And if you work out the numbers, this turns out to be a square matrix. This is a square matrix. This is a square matrix. It's this divided by this times this. It's an alternating product as you go back. That's the answer in general. Of course, you have to prove something to prove that this is all well-defined. This is well-developed technology. It's the equivalence of Plicker coordinates and dual Plicker coordinates in some other language. Many different formulations have been made of this. I once rediscovered it myself with David Buxbaum and some work we did in some other slightly different setting. So many people have done this. How could it fail to be true, what you were asking? But I don't know the connection. It's a good question. It must be, yes. I agree. I think that's a very smart remark, yeah.
It was also very reminiscent of Rademeister torsion in certain cell complexes.
Oh, yeah, this is Rademeister torsion. That's right. That's one of the places where this was discovered, rediscovered. Cayley had it first, I think, it's fair to say. Though he didn't say it so generally, he certainly wouldn't have known about the integers and free modules over them. But
a century earlier.
but he's almost a century early. He deserves a lot of credit, I think, for this brainstorm. This is more invariant than you could imagine in your wildest dreams. You can replace the complex by any quasi-isomorphic complex. So you can have a sequence of maps going in both directions from this complex to back and forth from other complexes. As long as they induce isomorphisms on homology and they're locally free complexes, you always get the same determinant up to a unit. You could take the associated gradient of this thing, you get the same determinant. Lots of invariances. It's a wonderful construction. All right, so Cayley's theorem was any resultant can be expressed as the determinant of a complex. And all the expressions after that for the next 100 years or so, well, till now, I guess, have been of this form. People write down more and more clever complexes. That's what they do. If you look in the literature, nobody says this. But nevertheless, that's what's going on. Grothendieck realized the general case and proved the same theorem for any Chow form. He didn't publish it, but he sent a letter to David Mumford. That was enough in the 60s. And Mumford and his student Knudsen worked this out in great detail. Knudsen's son, by the way, is now an assistant professor an assistant professor in Berkeley, Alan Knudsen. Anyway, so Mumford, you can read about this in painful but very complete detail in Knudsen and Mumford. Knudsen and Mumford. This is a paper in the mid-60s. However, what's the complex? So, to tell you the complex, I have to explain why this is so sort of useless without further technique. It's gotten this way. I look at projective space. I have a variety. Let me do the general cases now because they're clearer than the special cases. And I have the Grassmannian of codimension k plus 1 planes in Pn. I want to go from x to a hypersurface in this variety. So I form what's called the incidence correspondence. Gamma is the set of pairs. Gamma is contained in the product. So gamma is the set of pairs x, l in Pn across the Grassmannian such that x is in L. You can form gamma x just by taking the pre-image. Let's call this pi 1 and pi 2 for the two projections. So gamma x is pi 1 inverse of x, just the pre-image. You have pi 1 here. And then you can push this forward to the Grassmannian 2. And by pi 2. And so pi 2, pi 1 inverse of x. What does that mean? Pi 1 inverse of x is the set of all x, L, such that x is in L, and little x is in big X. In other words, it's the set of L's. If I just look at the second coordinates, which is what happens when I project, I get here the set of L's which meet x. Right? So the image of this is the Chow divisor. Now, how do I find a formula for it? Well, here's the trick. You take any sheaf whose support is x, or more generally, any coherent sheaf on projective space. There's a way of pulling it back. In Grothendieck, you take a line bundle, let's say, line, or in Cayley for that matter, on x. You pull it back, call this pi 1 upper star of f, and then you push it down. Now, Grothendieck and people around him realized that though there's a standard push forward operation, it's sort of not right. It isn't complete enough. And what you're supposed to do before you push this forward is to take an injective resolution. Now, no one will ever see an injective resolution of pi 1 upper star of f at some infinite object, which is hard to compute. So that's not much use. But anyway, you take one. That's just the I dot. And then you push forward pi 2 lower star of I dot. Now you have an object which is completely useless and incalculable, but Grothendieck proves it's isomorphic, quasi-isomorphic, in the sense that I'll make precise in a moment, to one of these finite locally free complexes. So in many, many ways, not at all unique, there is a locally free complex and a map between it and this thing, which is an isomorphism on homology. And then the theorem is that the determinant of F is the Chow form of X, or if you like, the Chow hypersurface associated to X. So that's the general construction. Now, in Cayley, of course, he didn't know about injective resolutions. What he did was to pull back a line bundle on projective space. Line bundles there are pretty simple. It's just S with a shifted grading, perhaps. You pull it back, and then you can't produce a resolution of it, but there's a kind of Kazul complex which will substitute for this. You can push forward the Kazul complex, and if the numbers you get are positive enough, then all higher cohomology vanishes, and this becomes a simple thing to compute, and he computed it in that case, and therefore got the resultants as determinants of explicit complexes. What Schreier and I have done, which is new, which I guess I don't have time to explain how to do, is to produce canonical complexes here, which are quasi-isomorphic to this, which define the push forward. They generalize, for those of you who are real experts, the Balanchine monad of a sheaf on projective space, sort of Balanchine Chow complexes. And they are very computable. A machine can now do this, turn out the complex, and then the Chow form. All the good cases, the cases where you get a formula, I said this, I guess, but I didn't emphasize it. The Chow form is a polynomial. The determinant of a complex is a rational function. There's a denominator. And when you write this thing down, what you get, in fact, is a huge numerator and a huge denominator, which almost completely cancel. That's an unpleasant kind of expression for a polynomial of low degree, but that's what the Chow form, that's what these computations normally give you. Unless the complex has just one term, in which case it is a determinant. And that's the kind of thing you like. So the whole study then is to find sheaves here so that the complex here becomes a single term, this canonical complex. And it turns out that they've appeared in the literature too. They've been studied by Bernd Ulrich and other people for completely other reasons. The cases that people knew before were cases where line bundles were sheaves with this property. And it's extremely rare that there are line bundles that are sheaves with this property, but it's much more common for higher rank vector bundles. In fact, it's a reasonable conjecture that on any smooth variety, there's a vector bundle supported with this nice property that the canonical Chow complex has just one term, and that would give you a power of the Chow form as a determinant for any complex. So maybe I should stop with those remarks. Thanks.
Questions?
The Balanchine, in general, if you take any sheaf on projective space, coherent sheaf, then there's a canonical way of realizing F as the homology. There is no other homology of a complex whose jth term, let's say, or eth term maybe, is the sum over J of the jth cohomology of F twisted by E minus J, tensored with omega, and now I think it's J minus E of J minus E, where omega is the sheaf of differentials, the cotangent bundle. And this means the exterior power of omega. This is a theorem proved, or at least stated, by Balanchine. Actually, this is a famous article in 1978. Balanchine states this theorem very clearly, and then he proves a completely different theorem. And he says, well, you could prove this theorem too by the same sort of ideas. Why didn't he do it? Well, it's a lot harder. That's why he didn't do it. What he proves is that actually that there's a spectral sequence which has these things as terms and converges to, doesn't give F as the homology, but it gives some associated gradient of F as the homology. That's what really is proved by his argument. And various people have then given more complete proofs. Anyway, these complexes turn out to... Well, the proofs are all existential in Balanson and elsewhere, but you can write these complexes down explicitly. This is something that Schreier and I and Gunnar Fleustadt have done. And they come actually from taking free resolutions over the exterior algebra. So associated with this sheaf, there's a natural, doubly infinite, exact free complex over the exterior algebra, the Tate complex of the sheaf, Tate resolution, whose terms look like this, tensored with exterior algebra here. And then there's a functor from free complexes over the exterior algebra to complexes like this of sheaves on projective space. But you could also, instead of taking this thing, omega 1 of 1 is not only the sheaf of differentials twisted by 1, it's also the universal subbundle on projective space. And it turns out that you can replace this by exterior powers of the universal subbundles on Grassmannians, and you still get a functor. If you apply that functor, you get this canonical Chow complex for the sheaf. So the Balanson complex is this Chow complex for the case where you looked at points, you know, the which points lie on the variety in Pn. Whereas if you want to look at subspaces, you have to go further down the chain. So that's the relation to the Balanson theorem. And of course, this is, I should say, all part of the circle of ideas around the Bernstein-Gelfand-Gelfand correspondence. That's the bounded derived category of coherent sheaves is equal to the bounded derived category of graded modules over an exterior algebra. Exterior modules, mod-free modules you have to take there. So this is a famous result of Bernstein-Gelfand-Gelfand, and in some way this theorem is an explicit version of the isomorphism, except that you can't write down the complex, so it isn't very explicit, or at least you couldn't until now. So in some sense, what we've done is to complete this circle of ideas of Bernstein-Gelfand-Gelfand and Balanson, both published in 78, and two papers in the Journal of Functional Analysis, actually, entitled On a Problem of Linear Algebra. This is the Russian journal. Apparently, they were both inspired by a lecture that Manin had given, and the two groups went off and worked on it in their own ways, and then they realized they had been working on the same problem, more or less. So typically, they didn't bother to reconcile the two papers or put them together. They just put them next to each other.
Any questions? Can you comment on
connection
with hyperplane complements?
Oh, yeah. So that is in a different direction. If you have any topological space, for example, the complement of a union of hyperplanes in CN, let's say, or a link complement, actually, is another good example where one can do something in this setting. CN minus union of hyperplanes. Certain link complements, not all, we can do this for, too. Then the cohomology of X, of course, is an algebra over the field, but it's actually an algebra over the exterior algebra on H1. The topologists think this is sort of childish. They like to think of the Steenrod algebra instead. But this is a piece that's there, and it's nice. So take the exterior algebra on H1. This is pretty useless if H1 happens to be 0. But in this case, for instance, H1 actually generates the cohomology algebra, and therefore this is not so uninteresting. So you might ask, what are the properties of this module? That's something that people have thought a little bit about, but not very intensely. And what we proved is that if you take, actually not this module, but the dual module, so think of H lower star of X, the homology of X, as a module over this exterior algebra. So this is a ring, let's call it E. This is an E module. This is generated in a single degree, the highest degree, which is, of course, known. This is the Ehrlich-Solomon algebra. This is not a very mysterious object. We know generators and relations. But still, it's hard to say what it means algebraically down in the algebra. Anyway, this is generated in a single degree, but also its syzygies are generated in a single degree, the next degree, and the syzygies of those, too. This has a completely linear resolution. the free resolution of this module over this algebra, some infinite free resolution, has only linear matrices in it, matrices of degree one forms. So that's what we proved. This is work with Popescu and Yuzvinsky. And as I say, it's true in some other cases too.
By going to 8-1, you are ignoring some delicacies in
Python. Of course. Of course, lots of delicacies.
So what kind of information would you lose?
Ooh, I haven't thought about what the analog of this in the Pi 1 case might be. It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. Huh. Yeah, don't know. There are good reasons for studying this. I could list now half a dozen good motivations. There are interesting problems in combinatorics which are related to this stuff too, and elsewhere. But my real motivation, my original motivation, was none of the above. In the general case, it was just that I had proved some theorem long ago about some analogous case, and I didn't know whether the analog would be true here or how to prove it. And I thought, gee, I ought to know that. In this case, there's a computer program, Macaulay 2, which will actually compute resolutions of things like this. And we began playing, Yuzvinsky and I, just because it was possible to play. And, my God, this pattern was awful simple. We felt that must have a reason, and it had, in the end, a rather pretty combinatorial reason. So these things come about, I find, not by intent or grand designs, but by just knowing different things and being curious how they put together, how they go together.
Well, I'd like to invite everyone to the reception that we're having afterwards. If you have more questions, let's thank the speaker one more time.